sudden and at last with regret. Nothing but the recollection of his oath gave him strength to proceed. Hunger rendered these viands, once so repugnant, acceptable to him. He held the plate in his hand for an hour at a time, and gazed on the morsel of bad meat, of tainted fish, of black and mouldy bread. It was the last struggle of life, which occasionally vanquished his resolve. Then his dungeon seemed less sombre, his prospects less desperate. He was still young. He was only 4 or 25. He had nearly 50 years to live. What unforeseen events might not open his prison door and restore him to liberty? Then he raised to his lips the repast that, like a voluntary Tantalus, he refused himself. But he thought of his oath, and he would not break it. He persisted until, at last, he had not sufficient force to cast his supper out of the loophole. The next morning he could not see or hear. The jailer feared he was dangerously ill. Edmund hoped he was dying. The day passed away thus. Edmund felt a species of stupor creeping over him. The gnawing pain at his stomach had ceased. His thirst had abated. When he closed his eyes, he saw myriads of lights dancing before them, like the meteors that play about the marshes. It was the twilight of that mysterious country called Death. Suddenly, about 9 o'clock in the evening, Edmund heard a hollow sound in the wall against which he was lying. So many loathsome animals inhabited the prison that their noise did not in general awake him. But whether abstinence had quickened his faculties, or whether the noise was really louder than usual, Edmund raised his head and listened. It was a continual scratching, as if made by a huge claw, a powerful tooth, or some iron instrument attacking the stones. Although weakened, the young man's brain instantly recurred to the idea that haunts all prisoners, liberty. It seemed to him that heaven had at length taken pity on him and had sent this noise to warn him on the very brink of the abyss. Perhaps one of those beloved ones he had so often thought of was thinking of him and striving to diminish the distance that separated them. No, no, doubtless he was deceived, and it was but one of those dreams that forerun death. Edmund still heard the sound. It lasted nearly 3 hours. He then heard a noise of something falling, and all was silent. Some hours afterwards, it began nearer and more distinct. Edmund became already interested in that labour when the jailer entered. For a week that he had resolved to die, and for 4 days that he put this resolution into execution, Edmund had not spoken to this man, had not answered him when he inquired what was the matter with him, and turned his face to the wall when he looked too curiously at him. But now the jailer might hear this noise and put an end to it, thus destroying a ray of something like hope that soothed his last moments. The jailer brought him his breakfast. Dantès raised himself up and began to speak on everything, on the bad quality of his food, on the coldness of his dungeon, grumbling and complaining, in order to have an excuse for speaking louder and wearying the patience of his jailer, who had solicited some broth and white bread for his prisoner, and who had brought it. Fortunately, he fancied Dantès was delirious, and placing his food on the rickety table, he withdrew. Edmund listened, and the sound became more and more distinct. There can be no doubt, thought he, it is some prisoner who is striving to obtain his freedom. Suddenly another idea took possession of his mind, so used to misfortune that it could scarcely understand hope. Yet this idea possessed him, that the noise arose from the workmen the governor had ordered to repair the neighbouring dungeon. It was easy to ascertain this, but how could he risk the question? It was easy to call his jailer's attention to the noise and watch his countenance as he listened, but might he not by this means betray interests far more precious than this short-lived satisfaction? Unfortunately, Edmund's brain was still so feeble that he could not bend his thoughts to anything in particular. He saw but one means of restoring lucidity and clearness to his judgment. He turned his eyes towards the soup his jailer had brought him, rose, staggered towards it, raised the vessel to his lips, and drank off the contents with a feeling of indescribable pleasure. He had often heard that shipwrecked persons had died through having eagerly devoured too much food. Edmund replaced on the table the bread he was about to devour, and returned to his couch. He did not wish to die. He soon felt that his ideas became again collected. He could think and strengthen his thoughts by reasoning. Then he said to himself, "I must put this to the test, but without compromising anybody. If it is a workman, I need but knock against the wall, and he will cease to work in order to find out who is knocking and why he does so. But as his occupation is sanctioned by the governor, he will soon resume it. If, on the contrary, it is a prisoner, the noise I make will alarm him. He will cease and not recommence until he thinks everyone is asleep." Edmund rose again, but this time his legs did not tremble and his eyes were free from mists. He advanced to a corner of his dungeon, detached a stone, and with it knocked against the wall where the sound came. He struck thrice. At the first blow, the sound ceased, as if by magic. Edmund listened intently. An hour passed, 2 hours passed, and no sound was heard from the wall. All was silent there. Full of hope, Edmund swallowed a few mouthfuls of bread and water, and thanks to the excellence of his constitution, found himself well-nigh recovered. The day passed away in utter silence. Night came without the noise having recommenced. "It is a prisoner," said Edmund joyfully. The night passed in perfect silence. Edmund did not close his eyes. In the morning, the jailer brought him fresh provisions. He had already devoured those of the previous day. He ate these, listening anxiously for the sound, walking round and round his cell, shaking the iron bars of the loophole, restoring by exercise vigor and agility to his limbs, and preparing himself thus for his future destiny. At intervals, he listened if the noise had not begun again, and grew impatient at the prudence of the prisoner, who did not guess he had been disturbed by a captive as anxious for liberty as himself. 3 days passed, 72 long, tedious hours. At length, one evening, as the jailer was visiting him for the last time that night, Dantès fancied he heard an almost imperceptible movement among the stones. Edmund recoiled from the wall, walked up and down his cell to collect his thoughts, and replaced his ear against the wall. There could be no doubt something was passing on the other side. The prisoner had discovered the danger and had substituted the lever for the chisel. Encouraged by this discovery, Edmund determined to assist the indefatigable labourer. He began by moving his bed, and sought with his eyes for anything with which he could pierce the wall, penetrate the cement, and displace a stone. He saw nothing. He had no knife or sharp instrument. The grating of his window alone was of iron, and he had too often assured himself of its solidity. All his furniture consisted of a bed, a chair, a table, a pail, and a jug. The bed had iron clamps, but they were screwed to the wood, and it would have required a screwdriver to take them off. The table and chair had nothing. The pail had had a handle, but that had been removed. Dantès had but one resource, which was to break the jug, and with one of the sharp fragments attack the wall. He let the jug fall on the floor, and it broke in pieces. Dantès concealed 2 or 3 of the sharpest fragments in his bed, leaving the rest on the floor. The breaking of his jug was too natural an accident to excite suspicion. Edmund had all the night to work in, but in the darkness he could not do much, and he soon felt his instrument was blunted against something hard. He pushed back his bed and awaited the day. All night he heard the subterranean workman, who continued to mine his way. The day came, the jailer entered. Dantès told him the jug had fallen from his hands in drinking, and the jailer went grumblingly to fetch another, without giving himself the trouble to remove the fragments of the broken one. He returned speedily, recommended the prisoner to be more careful, and departed. Dantès heard joyfully the key grate in the lock. He listened until the sound of steps died away, and then, hastily displacing his bed, saw by the faint light that penetrated into his cell that he had laboured uselessly the previous evening in attacking the stone instead of removing the plaster that surrounded it. The damp had rendered it friable, and Dantès saw joyfully the plaster detach itself. In small morsels, it is true, but at the end of half an hour he had scraped off a handful. A mathematician might have calculated that in 2 years, supposing that the rock was not encountered, a passage 20 feet long and 2 feet broad might be formed. The prisoner reproached himself with not having thus employed the hours he had passed in prayers and despair. In 6 years, the space he had been confined, what might he not have accomplished? In 3 days, he had succeeded with the utmost precaution in removing the cement and exposing the stone. The wall was formed of rough stones to give solidity, to which were embedded at intervals blocks of hewn stone. It was one of these he had uncovered, and which he must remove from its socket. Dantès strove to do so with his nails, but they were too weak. The fragments of the jug broke, and after an hour of useless toil, Dantès paused. Was he to be thus stopped at the beginning, and was he to wait inactive until his fellow workmen had completed his toils? Suddenly, an idea occurred to him. He smiled, and the perspiration dried on his forehead. The jailer always brought Dantès soup in an iron saucepan. This saucepan contained the soup of a second prisoner, for Dantès had remarked that it was either quite full or half empty, according as the turnkey gave it to himself or his companion first. The handle of this saucepan was of iron. Dantès would have given 10 years of his life in exchange for it. The jailer poured the contents of this saucepan into Dantès' plate, who, after eating his soup with a wooden spoon, washed the plate which thus served for every day. In the evening, Dantès placed his plate on the ground near the door. The jailer, as he entered, stepped on it and broke it. This time he could not blame Dantès. He was wrong to leave it there, but the jailer was wrong not to have looked before him. The jailer therefore contented himself with grumbling. Then he looked about him for something to pour the soup into. Dantès' whole furniture consisted of one plate. There was no alternative. "Leave the saucepan," said Dantès. "You can take it away when you bring me my breakfast." This advice was to the jailer's taste, as it spared him the necessity of ascending, descending, and ascending again. He left the saucepan. Dantès was beside himself with joy. He rapidly devoured his food, and after waiting an hour, lest the jailer should change his mind and return, he removed his bed, took the handle of the saucepan, inserted the point between the hewn stone and rough stones of the wall, and employed it as a lever. A slight oscillation showed Dantès all was well. At the end of an hour, the stone was extricated from the wall, leaving a cavity of a foot and a half in diameter. Dantès carefully collected the plaster, carried it into the corners of his cell, and covered it with earth. Then, wishing to make the best use of this night in which chance, or rather his own stratagem, had placed so precious an instrument in his hands, he continued to work without ceasing. At the dawn of day, he replaced the stone, pushed his bed against the wall, and lay down. The breakfast consisted of a piece of bread. The jailer entered and placed the bread on the table. "Well, you do not bring me another plate?" said Dantès. "No," replied the turnkey. "You destroy everything. First you break your jug, then you make me break your plate. If all the prisoners followed your example, the government would be ruined. I shall leave you the saucepan and pour your soup into that, so for the future I hope you will not be so destructive to your furniture." Dantès raised his eyes to heaven, clasped his hands beneath the coverlid, and prayed. He felt more gratitude for the possession of this piece of iron than he had ever felt for anything. He had, however, remarked that the prisoner on the other side had ceased to labour. No matter, this was a greater reason for proceeding. If his neighbour would not come to him, he would go to him. All day he toiled on untiringly, and by the evening he had succeeded in extracting 10 handfuls of plaster and fragments of stone. When the hour for his jailer's visit arrived, Dantès straightened the handle of the saucepan as well as he could, and placed it in its accustomed place. The turnkey poured his ration of soup into it, together with the fish, for thrice a week the prisoners were made to abstain from meat. This would have been a method of reckoning time, had not Dantès long ceased to do so. Having poured out the soup, the turnkey retired. Dantès wished to ascertain whether his neighbour had really ceased to work. He listened. All was silent as it had been for the last 3 days. Dantès sighed. It was evident that his neighbour distrusted him. However, he toiled on all the night without being discouraged, but after 2 or 3 hours he encountered an obstacle. The iron made no impression, but met with a smooth surface. Dantès touched it, and found it was a beam. This beam crossed, or rather blocked up, the hole that Dantès had made. It was necessary, therefore, to dig above or under it. The unhappy young man had not thought of this. "Oh, my God, "My God," murmured he, "I have so earnestly prayed to you that I hoped you would have heard me. After having deprived me of my liberty, after having deprived me of death, after having recalled me to existence, my God, have pity on me, and do not let me die in despair." "Who talks of God and despair at the same time?" said a voice that seemed to come from beneath the earth, and, deadened by the distance, sounded hollow and sepulchral in the young man's ears. Edmund's hair stood on end, and he rose on his knees. "Ah," said he, "I hear a human voice." Edmund had not heard anyone speak, save his jailer, for 4 or 5 years, and a jailer is not a man to a prisoner. He is a living door added to his door of oak, a barrier of flesh and blood added to his barriers of iron. "In the name of heaven," cried Dantès, "speak again, though the sound of your voice terrifies me." "Who are you?" said the voice. "An unhappy prisoner," replied Dantès, who made no hesitation in answering. "Of what country?" "A Frenchman." "Your name?" "Edmond Dantès." "Your profession?" "A sailor." "How long have you been here?" "Since the 28th of February, 1815. "Your crime?" "I am innocent." "But of what are you accused?" "Of having conspired to aid the Emperor's return." "How, for the Emperor's return?" "The Emperor is no longer on the throne, then?" "He abdicated at Fontainebleau in 1814 and was sent to the island of Elba. But how long have you been here that you are ignorant of all this?"
"Since 1811.
Dantès shuddered. This man had been 4 years longer than himself in prison.
"Do not dig any more," said the voice. "Only tell me, how high up is your excavation?"
"On a level with the floor."
"How is it concealed?"
"Behind my bed."
"Has your bed been moved since you have been a prisoner?"
"No."
"What does your chamber open on?"
"A corridor."
"And the corridor?"
"On a court."
"Alas!" murmured the voice.
"Oh, what is the matter?" said Dantès.
"I am deceived, and the imperfection of my plans has ruined all. An error of a line in the plan has been equivalent to 15 feet in reality, and I took the wall you are mining for the wall of the fortress."
"But then you were close to the sea?"
"That is what I hoped."
"And supposing you succeeded, I should have thrown myself into the sea, gained one of the islands near here, the Ile de Dorme or the Ile de Tiboulon, and then I was safe."
"Could you have swam so far?"
"Heaven would have given me strength. But now all is lost."
"All?"
"Yes. Stop up your excavation carefully. Do not work any more, and wait until you hear from me. Tell me at least who you are."
I am number 27.
"You mistrust me, then?" said Dantès. Edmund fancied he heard a bitter laugh proceed from the unknown.
"Oh, I am a Christian," cried Dantès, guessing instinctively that this man meant to abandon him. "I swear to you by him who died for us that naught shall induce me to breathe one syllable to my jailers. But I conjure you, do not abandon me. If you do, I swear to you that I will dash my brains out against the wall, and you will have my death to reproach yourself with."
"How old are you? Your voice is that of a young man."
"I do not know my age, for I have not counted the years I have been here. All I do know is that I was just 19 when I was arrested the 28th of February, 1815.
"Not quite 26, murmured the voice. "At that age he cannot be a traitor."
"Oh, no, no," cried Dantès. "I swear to you again, rather than betray you, they shall hew me to pieces."
"You have done well to speak to me and entreat me, for I was about to form another plan and leave you. But your age reassures me. I will not forget you. Expect me.
When?
I must calculate our chances. I will give you the signal, but you will not leave me. You will come to me, or you will let me come to you. We will escape, and if we cannot escape, we will talk. You, of those whom you love, and I, of those whom I love. You must love somebody."
"No, I am alone in the world. Then you will love me. If you are young, I will be your comrade. If you are old, I will be your son. I have a father who is 70, if he yet lives. I only love him and a young girl called Mercedes. My father has not yet forgotten me, I am sure, but God alone knows if she loves me still. I shall love you as I love my father. It is well, returned the voice. Tomorrow. These few words were uttered with an accent that left no doubt of his sincerity. Dantès rose, dispersed the fragments with the same precaution as before, and pushed back his bed against the wall. He then gave himself up to his happiness. He would no longer be alone. He was perhaps about to regain his liberty. At the worst, he would have a companion, and captivity that is shared is but half captivity. All day Dantès walked up and down his cell. He sat down occasionally on his bed, pressing his hand on his heart. At the slightest noise, he bounded towards the door. Once or twice the thought crossed his mind that he might be separated from this unknown whom he loved already, and then his mind was made up. When the jailer moved his bed and stooped to examine the opening, he would kill him with his water jug. He would be condemned to die, but he was about to die of grief and despair when this miraculous noise recalled him to life. The jailer came in the evening. Dantès was on his bed. It seemed to him that thus he better guarded the unfinished opening. Doubtless there was a strange expression in his eyes, for the jailer said, "Come, are you going mad again?" Dantès did not answer. He feared that the emotion of his voice would betray him. The jailer retired, shaking his head. The night came. Dantès hoped that his neighbor would profit by the silence to address him, but he was mistaken. The next morning, however, just as he removed his bed from the wall, he heard three knocks. He threw himself on his knees. "Is it you?" said he. "I am here." "Is your jailer gone?" "Yes," said Dantès. "He will not return until the evening, so that we have 12 hours before us." "I can work then," said the voice. "Oh, yes, yes, this instant, I entreat you." In an instant the portion of the floor on which Dantès, half buried in the opening, was leaning his two hands, gave way. He cast himself back, whilst a mass of stones and earth disappeared in a hole that opened beneath the aperture he himself had formed. Then, from the bottom of this passage, the depth of which it was impossible to measure, he saw appear, first the head, then the shoulders, and lastly the body of a man, who sprang lightly into his cell. 16. A Learned Italian. Rushing towards the friend so long and ardently desired, Dantès almost carried him towards the window in order to obtain a better view of his features by the aid of the imperfect light that struggled through the grating of the prison. He was a man of small stature, with hair blanched rather by suffering and sorrow than years. A deep-set, penetrating eye, almost buried beneath the thick grey eyebrow, and a long and still black beard reaching down to his breast. The meagreness of his features, deeply furrowed by care, joined to the bold outline of his strongly marked features, announced a man more accustomed to exercise his moral faculties than his physical strength. Large drops of perspiration were now standing on his brow, while his garments hung about him in such rags as to render it useless to form a guess as to their primitive description. The stranger might have numbered 60 or 65 years, but a certain briskness and appearance of vigour in his movements made it probable that he was aged more from captivity than the course of time. He received the enthusiastic greeting of his young acquaintance with evident pleasure, as though his chilled affections seemed rekindled and invigorated by his contact with one so warm and ardent. He thanked him with grateful cordiality for his kindly welcome, although he must at that moment have been suffering bitterly to find another dungeon where he had fondly reckoned on discovering a means of regaining his liberty. "Let us first see," said he, "whether it is possible to remove the traces of my entrance here. Our future comforts depend upon our jailers being entirely ignorant of it." Advancing to the opening, he stooped and raised the stone as easily as though it had not weighed an ounce. Then, fitting it into its place, he said, "You removed this stone very carelessly, but I suppose you had no tools to aid you." "Why?" exclaimed Dantès with astonishment. "Do you possess any?" "I made myself some, and with the exception of a file, I have all that are necessary, a chisel, pincers and lever. Oh, how I should like to see these products of your industry and patience. Well, in the first place, here is my chisel. So saying, he displayed a sharp, strong blade with a handle made of beechwood. And with what did you contrive to make that? Inquired Dantes. With one of the clamps of my bedstead, and this very tool has sufficed me to hollow out the road by which I came hither, a distance of at least 50 feet.
50 feet?
Re-echoed Dantes with a species of terror. Do not speak so loud, young man. Don't speak so loud. It frequently occurs in a state prison like this that persons are stationed outside the doors of the cells purposely to overhear the conversation of the prisoners. But they believe I am shut up alone here. That makes no difference. And you say that you penetrated a length of 50 feet to arrive here? I do. That is about the distance that separates your chamber from mine. Only, unfortunately, I did not curve aright. For want of the necessary geometrical instruments to calculate my scale of proportion, instead of taking an ellipse of 40 feet, I have made 50. I expected, as I told you, to reach the outer wall, pierce through it, and throw myself into the sea. I have, however, kept along the corridor on which your chamber opens instead of going beneath it. My labor is all in vain, for I find that the corridor looks into a courtyard filled with soldiers. That's true, said Dantes, but the corridor you speak of only bounds one side of my cell. There are three others. Do you know anything of their situation? This one is built against the solid rock, and it would take 10 experienced miners, duly furnished with the requisite tools, as many years to perforate it. This adjoins the lower part of the governor's apartments, and were we to work our way through, we should only get into some lock-up cellars where we must necessarily be recaptured. The fourth and last side of your cell looks out... Stop a minute. Now, where does it open to? The side which thus excited curiosity was the one in which was fixed the loophole by which the light was admitted into the chamber. This loophole, which gradually diminished as it approached the outside, until only an opening through which a child could not have passed, was, for better security, furnished with 3 iron bars, so as to quiet all apprehensions, even in the mind of the most suspicious jailer, as to the possibility of a prisoner's escape. As the stranger finished his self-put question, he dragged the table beneath the window. "Climb up," said he to Dantes. The young man obeyed, mounted on the table, and, divining the intentions of his companion, placed his back securely against the wall and held out both hands. The stranger, whom as yet Dantes knew only by his assumed title of the number of his cell, sprang up with an agility by no means to be expected in a person of his years, and, light and steady as the bound of a cat or a lizard, climbed from the table to the outstretched hands of Dantes, and from them to his shoulders, then, almost doubling himself in two, for the ceiling of the dungeon prevented his holding himself erect, he managed to slip his head through the top bar of the window so as to be able to command a perfect view from top to bottom. An instant afterwards he hastily drew back his head, saying, "I thought so," and sliding from the shoulders of Dantes as dexterously as he had ascended, he nimbly leapt from the table to the ground. "What made you say those words?" asked the young man, in an anxious tone, in his turn descending from the table. The elder prisoner appeared to meditate. "Yes," said he at length, "it is so. This side of your chamber looks out upon a kind of open gallery, where patrols are continually passing and sentries keep watch day and night. Are you quite sure of that?" "Certain. I saw the soldier's shako and the top of his musket. That made me draw in my head so quickly, for I was fearful he might also see me." "Well?" inquired Dantes. "You perceive, then, the utter impossibility of escaping through your dungeon." "Then," pursued the young man eagerly, "then," answered the elder prisoner, "the will of God be done." And as the old man slowly pronounced those words, an air of profound resignation spread itself over his careworn countenance. Dantès gazed on the individual who could thus philosophically resign hopes so long and ardently nourished with an astonishment mingled with admiration. "Tell me, I entreat of you, who and what you are," said he at length. "Never have I met with so remarkable a person as yourself." "Willingly," answered the stranger, "if indeed you feel any curiosity respecting one now, alas, powerless to aid you in any way, say not so. You can console and support me by the strength of your own powerful mind. Pray let me know who you really are." The stranger smiled a melancholy smile. "Then listen," said he. "I am the Abbé Faria, and have been imprisoned in this Chateau d'If since the year 1811, previously to which I had been confined for 3 years in the fortress of Fenestrelle. In the year 1811 I was transferred to Piedmont in France. It was at this period I learned that the destiny which seemed subservient to every wish formed by Napoleon had bestowed on him a son, named King of Rome even in his cradle. I was very far then from expecting the change you have just informed me of, namely that 4 years afterwards this colossus of power would be overthrown. Then who reigns in France at this moment? Napoleon II? No, Louis XVIII, the brother of Louis XVI. How inscrutable are the ways of Providence! For what great and mysterious purpose has it pleased heaven to abase the man once so elevated and raise up the individual so beaten down and depressed? Dante's whole attention was riveted on a man who could thus forget his own misfortunes while occupying himself with the destinies of others. "But so it was," continued he, "in England. After Charles I came Cromwell. To Cromwell succeeded Charles II, and then James II, who was succeeded by some son-in-law or relation." "Ah, my friend," said the abbé, turning towards Dantès and surveying him with the kindling gaze of a prophet, "these are the changes and vicissitudes that give liberty to a nation. Mark what I say. You are young, and may see my words come to pass that such will be the case with France. You will see it, I say. Probably, if ever I get out of prison." "True," replied Faria. "We are prisoners. But I forget this sometimes, and there are even moments when my mental vision transports me beyond these walls, and I fancy myself at liberty. But wherefore are you here? Because in 1807 I meditated the very scheme Napoleon wished to realize in 1811. Because, like Machiavel, I desired to alter the political face of Italy, and instead of allowing it to be split up into a quantity of petty principalities, each held by some weak or tyrannical ruler, I sought to form one large, compact, and powerful empire. And lastly, because I fancied I had found my Caesar Borgia in a crowned simpleton who feigned to enter into my views only to betray me. It was projected equally by Alexander VI and Clement VII, but it will never succeed now, for they attempted it fruitlessly, and Napoleon was unable to complete his work. Italy seems fated to be unlucky." The old man uttered these last words in a tone of deep dejection, and his head fell listlessly on his breast. To Dantès, all this was perfectly incomprehensible. In the first place, he could not understand a man risking his life and liberty for such unimportant matters as the division of a kingdom. Then again, the persons referred to were wholly unknown to him. Napoleon, certainly, he knew something of, inasmuch as he had seen and spoken with him, but the other individuals alluded to were strangers to him even by name. "Pray excuse my question," said Dantès, beginning to partake of the jailer's opinion, touching the state of the abbé's brain. "But are you not the priest who is considered throughout the Chateau d'If to be ill?" "Mad, you mean, don't you? I did not like to say so," answered Dantès, smiling.
"Well, then," resumed Faria, with a bitter smile, "let me answer your question in full by acknowledging that I am the poor, mad prisoner of the Chateau d'If. For many years permitted to amuse the different visitants to the prison with what is said to be my insanity, and, in all probability, I should be promoted to the honour of making sport for the children, if such innocent beings could be found in an abode devoted like this to suffering and despair." Dantès remained for a short time mute and motionless. At length he said, "Then you abandon all hope of flight? I perceive its utter impossibility, and I consider it impious to attempt that which the Almighty evidently does not approve. Nay, be not discouraged. Would it not be expecting too much to hope to succeed at your first attempt? Why not try to find an opening in another direction to that which had so unfortunately failed? Alas! It shows how little notion you can have of all it has cost me to effect a purpose so unexpectedly frustrated that you talk of beginning over again. In the first place, I was 4 years making the tools I possess, and have been 2 years scraping and digging out earth hard as granite itself. Then what toil and fatigue has it not been to remove huge stones I should once have deemed impossible to loosen? Whole days have I passed in these titanic efforts, considering my labor well repaid if by night-time I had contrived to carry away a square inch of this hard-bound cement, changed by ages into a substance unyielding as the stones themselves. Then to conceal the mass of earth and rubbish I dug up, I was compelled to break through a staircase and throw the fruits of my labor into the hollow part of it. But the well is now so completely choked up that I scarcely think it would be possible to add another handful of dust without leading to a discovery. Consider also that I fully believed I had accomplished the end and aim of my undertaking, for which I had so exactly husbanded my strength as to make it just hold out to the termination of my enterprise. And just at the moment when I reckoned upon success, my hopes are forever dashed from me. No, I repeat again that nothing shall induce me to renew attempts evidently at variance with the Almighty's pleasure." Dantès held down his head that his companion might not perceive how little of real regret at the failure of the scheme was expressed on his countenance. But in truth, the young man could entertain no other feeling than delight at finding his prison would be no longer solitary or uncheered by human participation. The abbé sunk upon Edmund's bed, while Edmund himself remained standing, lost in a train of deep meditation. Flight had never once occurred to him. There are, indeed, some things which appear so morally impossible that the mind does not dwell on them for an instant. To undermine the ground for 50 feet, to devote 3 years to a labour which, if successful, would conduct you to a precipice overhanging the sea, to plunge into the waves at a height of 50 or 60 feet, at the risk of being dashed to pieces against the rocks, should you have been fortunate enough to have escaped the balls from the sentinel's musket, and even supposing all these perils passed, then to have to swim for your life a distance of at least 3 miles ere you could reach the shore, were difficulties so startling and formidable that Dantès had never even dreamed of such a scheme, but resigned himself to his fate. But the sight of an old man clinging to life with so desperate a courage gave a fresh turn to his ideas and inspired him with new courage and energy. An instance was before him of one less adroit, as well as weaker and older, having devised a plan which nothing but an unfortunate mistake in geometrical calculation could have rendered abortive. This same individual, with almost incredible patience and perseverance, had contrived to provide himself with tools requisite for so unparalleled an attempt. If, then, one man had already conquered the seeming impossibility, why should not he, Dantès, also try to regain his liberty?
Faria had made his way through 50 feet of the prison, Dantes resolved to penetrate through double that distance. Faria, at the age of 50, had devoted 3 years to the task. He, who was but half as old, would sacrifice 6. Faria, a churchman and philosopher, had not shrunk from risking his life by trying to swim a distance of 3 miles to reach the isles of Dorme, Ratonneau, or La Mer. Should a hardy sailor and experienced diver like himself shrink from a similar task? Should he, who had so often for mere amusement's sake plunged to the bottom of the sea to fetch up the bright coral branch, hesitate to swim a distance of 3 miles? He could do it in an hour, and how many times had he, for pure pastime, continued in the water for more than twice as long? At once, Dantes resolved to follow the brave example of his energetic companion, and to remember that what has once been done may be done again. After continuing some time in profound meditation, the young man suddenly exclaimed, "I have found what you were in search of." Faria started. "Have you indeed?" cried he, raising his head with quick anxiety. "Pray let me know what it is you have discovered. The corridor through which you have bored your way from the cell you occupy here extends in the same direction as the outer gallery, does it not?" "It does." "And is not above 15 steps from it?" "About that. Well, then, I will tell you what we must do. We must pierce through the corridor by forming a side opening about the middle, as it were the top part of a cross. This time you will lay your plans more accurately. We shall get out into the gallery you have described, kill the sentinel who guards it, and make our escape. All we require to ensure success is courage, and that you possess, and strength, which I am not deficient in. As for patience, you have abundantly proved yours. You shall now see me prove mine." "One instant, my dear friend," replied the abbé. "It is clear you do not understand the nature of the courage with which I am endowed, and what use I intend making of my strength. As for patience, I consider I have abundantly exercised that on recommencing every morning the task of the overnight, and every night beginning again the task of the day. But then, young man, and I pray of you to give me your full attention, then I thought I could not be doing anything displeasing to the Almighty in trying to set an innocent being at liberty, one who had committed no offence and merited not condemnation."
"And have your notions changed?" asked Dantes with much surprise. "Do you think yourself more guilty in making the attempt since you have encountered me?"
"No. Neither do I wish to incur guilt. Hitherto I have fancied myself merely waging war against circumstances, not men. I have thought it no sin to bore through a wall or destroy a staircase, but I cannot so easily persuade myself to pierce a heart or take away a life."
A slight movement of surprise escaped Dantes.
"Is it possible," said he, "that where your liberty is at stake you can allow any such scruple to deter you from obtaining it?"
"Tell me," replied Faria, "what has hindered you from knocking down your jailer with a piece of wood torn from your bedstead, dressing yourself in his clothes and endeavouring to escape?"
"Simply that I never thought of such a scheme," answered Dantes. "Because," said the old man, "the natural repugnance to the commission of such a crime prevented its bare idea from occurring to you. And so it ever is with all simple and allowable things. Our natural instincts keep us from deviating from the strict line of duty. The tiger, whose nature teaches him to delight in shedding blood, needs but the organ of smelling to know when his prey is within his reach, and by following this instinct he is enabled to measure the leap necessary to enable him to spring on his victim. But man, on the contrary, loathes the idea of blood. It is not alone that the laws of social life inspire him with a shrinking dread of taking life. His natural construction and physiological formation..." Dantes remained confused and silenced by this explanation of the thoughts which had unconsciously been working in his mind, or rather, soul. For there are two distinct sorts of ideas, those that proceed from the head and those that emanate from the heart. "Since my imprisonment," said Faria, "I have thought over all the most celebrated cases of escape recorded. Among the many that have failed in obtaining the ultimate release of the prisoner, I consider there has been a precipitation, a haste, wholly incompatible with such undertakings. Those escapes that have been crowned with full success have been long meditated upon and carefully arranged. Such, for instance, as the escape of the Duc de Beaufort from the Château de Vincennes, that of the Abbé Dubuquoi from Fort-l'Évêque, Latudes from the Bastille, with similar cases of successful evasion. And I have come to the conclusion that chance frequently affords opportunities we should never ourselves have thought of. Let us, therefore, wait patiently for some favorable moment. Rely upon it, you will not find me more backward than yourself in seizing it. Ah, said Dantès, you might well endure the tedious delay. You were constantly occupied in the task you set yourself, and when weary with toil, you had your hopes to refresh and encourage you. I assure you, replied the old man, I did not turn to that source for recreation or support. What did you do then? I wrote or studied. Were you then permitted the use of pens, ink, and paper? Oh, no, answered the abbé. I had none but what I made for myself. Do you mean to tell me, exclaimed Dantès, that you could invent all those things, for real ones you could not procure unaided? I do indeed, truly say so. Dantès gazed with kindling eyes and rapidly increasing admiration on the wonderful being whose hand seemed gifted with the power of a magician's wand. Some doubt, however, still lingered in his mind, which was quickly perceived by the penetrating eye of the abbé. "When you pay me a visit in my cell, my young friend," said he, "I will show you an entire work, the fruits of the thoughts and reflections of my whole life, many of them meditated over in the ruins of the Colosseum of Rome, at the foot of St. Mark's Column at Venice, and on the borders of the Arno at Florence, little imagining at the time that they would be arranged in order within the walls of the Chateau d'If. The work I speak of is called A Treatise on the Practicability of Forming Italy into One General Monarchy, and will make one large quarto volume. And on what have you written all this? On two of my shirts. I invented a preparation that makes linen as smooth and as easy to write on as parchment. You are then a chemist? Somewhat. I know Lavoisier, and was the intimate friend of Cabanis. But for such a work you must have needed books. Had you any? I possessed nearly 5,000 volumes in my library at Rome, but after reading them over many times I found out that with 150 well-chosen books a man possesses a complete analysis of all human knowledge, or at least all that is either useful or desirable to be acquainted with. I devoted 3 years of my life to reading and studying these 150 volumes till I knew them nearly by heart, so that since I have been in prison, a very slight effort of memory has enabled me to recall their contents as readily as though the pages were open before me. I could recite you the whole of Thucydides, Xenophon, Plutarch, Titus Livius, Tacitus, Strada, Hernandez, Dante Montaigne, Shakespeare, Spinoza, Machiavelli, and Bossuet. Observe, I merely quote the most important names and writers. You are doubtless acquainted with a variety of languages, so as to have been able to read all these. Yes. I speak 5 of the modern tongues, that is to say German, French, Italian, English, and Spanish. By the aid of ancient Greek, I learned modern Greek. I don't speak it so well as I could wish, but I am still trying to improve myself.
Improve yourself? Repeated Dantès. Why? How can you manage to do so?
Why, I made a vocabulary of the words I knew, turned, returned, and arranged them so as to enable me to express my thoughts through their medium.
I know nearly 1,000 words, which is all that is absolutely necessary, although I believe there are nearly 100,000 in the dictionaries. I cannot hope to be very fluent, but I certainly should have no difficulty in explaining my wants and wishes, and that would be quite as much as I should ever require.
Stronger grew the wonder of Dantes, who almost fancied he had to do with one gifted with supernatural powers. Still hoping to find some imperfection which might bring him down to a level with human beings, he added, "Then, if you were not furnished with pens, how did you manage to write the work you speak of? I made myself some excellent ones, which would be universally preferred to all others if once known. You are aware what huge whitings are served to us on Maigre days. Well, I selected the cartilages of the heads of these fishes, and you can scarcely imagine the delight with which I welcomed the arrival of each Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, as affording me the means of increasing my stock of pens. For I will freely confess that my historical labors have been my greatest solace and relief. While retracing the past, I forget the present, and while following the free and independent course of historical record, I cease to remember that I am myself immured within the gloomy walls of a dungeon." "But the ink requisite for copying down your ideas," said Dantes, "how have you procured that?"
"I will tell you," replied Faria. "There was formerly a fireplace in my dungeon, but it was closed up long before I became an occupant of this prison. Still, it must have been many years in use, for it was thickly covered with a coating of soot. This soot I dissolved in a portion of the wine brought to me every Sunday, and I assure you a better ink cannot be desired. For very important notes, for which closer attention is required, I have pricked one of my fingers and written the facts claiming notice in blood."
"And when," asked Dantes, "will you show me all this?"
"Whenever you please," replied the abbe.
"Oh, then, let it be directly," exclaimed the young man.
"Follow me, then," said the abbe, as he re-entered the subterranean passage, in which he soon disappeared, followed by Dantes.
17. In the Abbe's Cell. After having passed with tolerable ease through the subterranean passage, which, however, did not permit of their holding themselves erect, the two friends reached the farther end of the corridor, into which the cell of the abbe opened. From that point, the opening became much narrower, barely permitting an individual to creep through on his hands and knees. The floor of the abbe's cell was paved, and it had been by raising one of the stones in the most obscure corner that Faria had been able to commence the laborious task of which Dantes had witnessed the completion. As he entered the chamber of his friend, Dantes cast around one eager and searching glance in quest of the expected marvels, but nothing more than common met his view.
"It is well," said the abbe. "We have some hours before us. It is now just 12:15.
Instinctively, Dantes turned round to observe by what watch or clock the abbe had been able so accurately to specify the hour.
"Look at this ray of light which enters by my window," said the abbe, "and then observe the lines traced on the wall. Well, by means of these lines, which are in accordance with the double motion of the earth, as well as the ellipses it describes round the sun, I am enabled to ascertain the precise hour with more minuteness than if I possessed a watch, for that might be broken or deranged in its movements, while the sun and earth never vary in their appointed paths."
This last explanation was wholly lost upon Dantes, who had always imagined, from seeing the sun rise from behind the mountains and set in the Mediterranean, that it moved and not the earth. A double movement in the globe he inhabited, and of which he could feel nothing, appeared to him perfectly impossible. Still, though unable to comprehend the full meaning of his companion's allusions, each word that fell from his lips seemed fraught with the wonders of science, as admirable deserving of being brought fully to light
as were the glittering treasures he could just recollect having visited during his earliest youth in a voyage he made to Guzra and Golconda. "Come," said he to the abbey, "show me the wonderful inventions you told me of. I am all impatience to behold them." The abbé smiled, and proceeding to the disused fireplace, raised by the help of his chisel a long stone which had doubtless been the hearth, beneath which was a cavity of considerable depth, serving as a safe depository of the articles mentioned to Dantès.
"What do you wish to see first?" asked the abbé.
"Oh, your great work on the monarchy of Italy."
Faria then drew forth from its hiding-place 3 or 4 rolls of linen, laid one over the other like the folds of papyrus found in mummy-cases. These rolls consisted of slips of cloth about 4 inches wide and 18 long. They were all carefully numbered and closely covered with writing, so legible that Dantès could easily read it, as well as make out the sense, it being in Italian, a language he, as a Provençal, perfectly understood.
"There," said he, "there is the work complete. I wrote the word fini at the end of the last page about a week ago. I have torn up 2 of my shirts and as many handkerchiefs as I was master of to complete the precious pages. Should I ever get out of prison and find a printer courageous enough to publish what I have composed, my literary reputation is forever secured."
"I see," answered Dantès. "Now let me behold the curious pens with which you have written your work."
"Look," said Faria, showing to the young man a slender stick about 6 inches long, and much resembling the size of the handle of a fine painting brush, to the end of which was tied by a piece of thread one of those cartilages of which the abbé had before spoken to Dantès. It was pointed and divided at the nib like an ordinary pen. Dantès examined it with intense admiration, then looked around to see the instrument with which it had been shaped so correctly into form.
"Ah, I see," said Faria. "You are wondering where I found my penknife, are not you? Well, I must confess that I look upon that article of my ingenuity as the very perfection of all my handiworks. I made it, as well as this knife, out of an old iron candlestick."
The penknife was sharp and keen as a razor. As for the other knife, it possessed the double advantage of being capable of serving either as a dagger or a knife. Dantès examined the various articles shown to him with the same attention he had bestowed on the curiosities and strange tools exhibited in the shops at Marseille as the works of the savages in the South Seas, from whence they had been brought by the different trading vessels.
"As for the ink," said Faria, "I told you how I managed to obtain that, and I only just make it from time to time as I require it."
"There is one thing puzzles me still," observed Dantès, "and that is how you managed to do all this by daylight."
"I worked at night also," replied Faria.
"Night?
Why, for heaven's sake, are your eyes like cats that you can see to work in the dark?
Indeed, they are not. But a beneficent creator has supplied man with intelligence and ability to supply the want of the power you allude to. I furnish myself with a light quite as good as that possessed by the cat."
"You did? Pray tell me how."
"I separated the fat from the meat served to me, melted it, and made a most capital oil. Here is my lamp."
So saying, the abbé exhibited a sort of vessel very similar to those employed upon the occasion of public illuminations.
"But how do you procure a light?" "Oh, here are 2 flints and a morsel of burnt linen."
"And your matches?"
"Were easily prepared. I feigned a disorder of the skin and asked for a little sulphur, which was readily supplied."
Dantès laid the different things he had been looking at gently on the table and stood with his head drooping on his breast, as though overwhelmed by the persevering spirit and strength of character developed in each fresh trait of his newfound friend's conduct.
"You have not seen all yet," continued Faria, "for I did not think it wise to trust all my treasures in the same hiding-place. Let us shut this one up, and then you shall see what else I have to display."
Dantès helped him to replace the stone as they first found it. The abbe sprinkled a little dust over it to conceal the traces of its having been removed, rubbed his foot well on it to make it assume the same appearance as the other, and then, going towards his bed, he removed it from the spot it stood in. Behind the head of the bed, and concealed by a stone fitting in so closely as to defy all suspicion, was a hollow space, and in this space a ladder of cords between 25 and 30 feet in length. Dantès closely and eagerly examined it. He found it firm, solid, and compact enough to bear any weight.
"Who supplied you with the materials for making this wonderful work?" asked Dantès. "No one but myself. I tore up several of my shirts and unraveled the sheets of my bed during my 3 years' imprisonment at Fenestrelle, and when I was removed to the Château d'If, I managed to bring the ravelings with